The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Ladies and gentlemen, I lied. We're not broadcasting live. Broadcasting live to tape. In other words, we're pre-recorded. Now, a lot of you, we're always pre-recorded anyways, but we are pre-recorded today because we're on vacation. Now, as you know, Monday and Tuesday of this week, we played brand new interviews that I did for the Majority Report. Both fascinating interviews. Tomorrow, Thursday, the next day, Friday, brand new Majority Report interviews. Today, what we're doing is this. I'm running two interviews from Ring of Fire Radio. And I don't know. Maybe, I sort of feel like I want to run three. So Ring of Fire Radio is another show I do that is on 40-some-odd terrestrial stations across the country. It's a weekend show. It was a show that started on Air America Radio. I used to do it pretty consistently with Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy Jr. Those guys have more or less since moved on. Occasionally, they'll come back on. But for the most part, it's just me now. And it is a little bit different than the Majority Report. We do shorter interviews, tend to be a little bit more timely. And then we do a weekly news and review more often than not with Digby. So it's a little bit different stylistically. And there's a couple of interviews that I really wanted to share with you. And now that occurs to me, there's a third one that I want to share too. But I don't know if we can do, can we do 60 minutes of an interview? That would be too much. All right. So look, we're going to do two. And I don't know. I don't know if we're going to do these two or maybe the third. I'm going to announce all three of them because that's the way I roll. So I did an interview with Alana Massey. She is from Allure Magazine. We're definitely playing this. This is about SESTA. It is basically a stop online trafficking bill, online sex trafficking, or I should say it's like stop sex trafficking online bill. It is a bill ostensibly to help people who are being who are victims of sex trafficking. But Alana Massey lays out for us why this bill does not do what people think it does and why it should be opposed. And of course, you know, there's a real problem in this country that, you know, I don't want to go into. It probably goes back to our Puritan foundations where people who work in sex workers are treated as sort of second-class citizens. I mean, you see it with Stormy Daniels. Somehow, you know, she has no integrity because she does pornographic films. As if everybody doesn't have sex, and as if people don't sell themselves at their jobs. Right? Like, I mean, I'm sorry, but the fact of the matter is that I am perfectly willing to argue about the moral turpitude, the moral status of a pornographic film star versus, let's say, someone who's at the Pentagon and spending their days trying to figure out how we're going to kill more people. Okay. And frankly, the president of the United States is a horrible liar. So obviously your job does not necessarily say anything to your credibility. But the problem is that there's this sort of predisposition amongst people in this country. And so a lot of the people who work in the sex industry, they're not being listened to on this instance of sex trafficking. Real problem. The second interview is either going to be Khalil Jahan Muhammad. He is a Harvard history professor. And he wrote, and it's interesting to me because he writes about how the alt-right is using fake science essentially to justify their racism. And this came up with Sam Harris last week. I'm not saying he's all right. Everybody take it easy. Don't freak out. But there is, he had, you know, Charles Murray on trying to justify his racism with supposed data. And I like how Sam Harris, like, sort of managed to both platform this guy and say, like, I'm only platforming him because people don't want me to. Honestly, that's what he said, right? He said, I don't agree with anything that Charles Murray says, but I'm going to give him a platform because I know it will be upsetting to people. Wow. You know, maybe we should, I don't know, slap around a baby just because we know that it's going to be upsetting to people to watch it. And nobody else has the guts to videotape themselves slapping around a baby. I'm brave enough to put on a blatant racist, but only because I know that that's going to bother people. I mean, honestly, this is the public intellectual. Anyways, so it could be this Harvard history professor, Khalil Jahan Muhammad. A fascinating interview. But there was also another interview I did with Lena Putnam, and I've referenced that research multiple times now on both Ring of Fire and the Majority Report. She did this research paper with Theda Skocpol about what's happening in the suburbs and in like in Pennsylvania and places like Georgia with women, with tend to be a little bit older, tend to be better educated, tend to be white. Obviously, and it's a story because, you know, look, the fact of the matter is that black women have been the consistent bedrock of Democratic politics for a long time. This is interesting because there's a new group of people who are entering into politics, not just to vote, but to organize. And so we may play that interview, whatever. We're going to play two of those interviews. And the reason I'm doing that is in part to just introduce you to Ring of Fire Radio. I haven't done this in a long time. Ring of Fire Radio, you can go to rofpodcast.com. There's a free weekly hour-long podcast. Then there's also a membership option. But check out the podcast because the reason why I do both these shows, to be honest with you, Ring of Fire is not exactly the cash cow that one would imagine. But on the Majority Report, I like to do a 30-minute interview, 25-minute interview more often than not. But there's some pieces of news that just can't sustain that length of an interview. And so Ring of Fire Radio, I do that. Some people tell me, like, I like that format better. Okay, fine. That's why I do both. So here's a taste of those two interviews. Now, they still have, like, all the accoutrement because it is terrestrial radio. So there's a break. They're 9-minute segments, more or less. And so enjoy. And then, because this still is the Majority Report, folks, you're going to get a deep archive Matt pick. Deep archive Matt pick. All right, quick break. When we come back, first one up will be Alana Massey from Allure Magazine, and then it'll either be Khalil Jahan Muhammad or Lena Putnam. And remember, all new interview tomorrow and Friday, Majority Report style. See you later. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This month, Congress is considering whether to pass legislation intended to combat sex trafficking online with a bill entitled Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, or SESTA. This bill may be well intentioned, but it's actually going to be more detrimental to those who it's defined to protect. Here to explain why this bill is a bad idea, Alana Massey from Allure Magazine. So, Alana, tell us what the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act of 2017, tell us what the genesis of this bill is. I mean, I think for people who are not familiar with this issue, it sounds like a good thing to stop enabling sex traffickers. But tell us about the problem of sex trafficking and then the genesis of this bill.
So the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act is, on its surface, of course, as you mentioned, a great idea because no one wants to be enabling sex traffickers. The problem with this bill and the many that have preceded it are that the constitutionality of it and also the potential efficacy of it is completely unsubstantiated by the folks who are supporting it. So the primary issue with sex trafficking in the eyes of legislators who have created this bill in particular and ones that have come before it that have attempted to do the same thing is that it relies on the belief that advertisements for sexual services are the primary locations for sex trafficking to take place, and therefore getting rid of the ads means getting rid of sex trafficking. And they've relied on this idea to shut down sites like Redbook in the Bay Area, which was a local one, in order to shut down things like Craigslist's erotic services section, to come after various subsections on Backpage, which is still in operation. And the reality is that having the ads up is not what stops sex trafficking. And the way they want to get rid of the ads is through what many people who advocate for people in the sex trade who are both there consensually or they're under coercion or under actual trafficking circumstances, as well as people in the tech industry who understand freedom of expression online, is that it would require amendments to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which some people consider...
All right, hold on, Elena. Before we get into that, let's back up just a little bit, because I'm not sure, frankly, that broadly people understand the scope and the nature of the problem of sex trafficking in this country. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are simply misunderstand what the nature of the problem is and the scope of it. So let's start. Let's just back up a little bit. And first talk about what is the problem ostensibly that this is trying to solve? How widespread is sex trafficking? What constitutes sex trafficking? What is the nature of it in this country these days?
One of the main issues about bringing information to the public about sex trafficking and actually combating it in our country is that people have a very visceral and gruesome and very particular idea of what sex trafficking looks like and who does it and how it acts in the world on people who are victimized by it. And so, you know, these images are of, you know, shackled teenagers and really grisly sort of like mafia members who are committing these acts for the sake of their sadistic pleasure by forcing people into trading sex against their will and not receiving compensation for it, or being coerced and kept held captive in other means. And that is, of course, a very sort of, it's something that looks like that more often in movies than it does in real life. Like, real trafficking cases actually look a lot like, you know, the very boring visuals we have of people who are in poverty, who don't have access to living wages, finding themselves more prone to being exploited by other people in order to access a wage of some kind, or to access housing, or to, you know, have food available to them, to prevent deportation if their immigration status is threatened by someone who is coercive. Frequently, people who are identified as trafficked under the law do not personally identify with that term as having, as being something that happens to them, to describe their situation. And so identifying who is trafficked is actually really sort of painful and traumatic, and it forces a legal identity onto a person whose experiences of coercion and sexual exploitation and of poverty and marginalization are substantially more complicated, and they don't feel that the word accurately describes their experience.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. So, all right. So if I'm clear here, part of the one of the challenges that we have in the context of both law enforcement and in terms of formulating policy to protect people who fall within this class of people as being sex trafficked is that there's not even awareness by those people that that is the context of their situation. So we could be talking about whether it's immigrants who are brought to this country, they have no support systems, and so they become reliant on the people that have brought them over, and they fall into a situation where they are forced into some type of providing sexual service that is where they don't have necessarily, I guess, autonomy over their over that business. Or they don't have access to their money. And this can also happen internally in the country. And I would imagine that happens more often than not with younger people where they are they're in a new city and they fall into a similar dynamic. And so these people are not identifying as having been sex trafficked. So is there any sort of, I guess, intervention by police, by law enforcement, on that level? Because this is when we talk about, and we'll get back to SESTA in a moment, that's a second order issue, it seems to me. In terms of that first order, is there any other way for them to provide intervention?
This is the big problem about addressing trafficking, is that there is absolutely no population that is considered more potentially dangerous and not a friend and doing more harm than good than law enforcement for people who are both in the sex trade willingly and consensually and for people who are victims of coercion and trafficking. The reasons for this are the same reasons that get people into trafficked situations are people who are routinely left out of institutional and social services that would make it possible for them to make a living wage. So like trans teenagers of color who are kicked out of their homes or who, you know, can't sleep at the homeless shelter because they don't have a policy for how to house trans people, or because, you know, they don't have access to services, or because, you know, the police are threatening those folks with criminalization on a number of other levels already. And because law enforcement, when they do attempt to make sort of interventions into trafficking situations, they arrest the person who is considered trafficked. They sometimes charge them. They have been convicted on many cases, including of trafficking themselves, because of the way the laws about this are designed and the way they're written. And because we have such a limited, you know, sort of legislative and law enforcement imagination about how to address this social
phenomena.
The answer is just people have told, you know, law enforcement, they've told their, you know, their legislators, they've told their community organizers, they've told everyone what their needs are. And it's like really simple stuff that everyone needs, like living wages, like care for their children during, you know, their working hours, food, housing that is, you know, not precarious or uncertain or reliant on, you know, documents that prove American citizenship.
Alana, let me just break it there, because we got to break for a break. But when we come back, let's talk about SESTA and how misguided this is, and how this may be legislation that even is worse than it not helping the people that it's meant to help. We got to take a quick break. I'll be right back. Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to Alana Massey about her article in Allure magazine. If you care about sex trafficking, trust people in the sex trades, not celebrities. So, Alana, in the last segment, you were explaining to us that one of the greatest challenges of dealing with sex trafficking in this country is that, the people who are victims of sex trafficking do not necessarily identify themselves as being victims of sex trafficking. They don't perceive themselves as being part of a broader class of people, but rather that they have fallen into circumstances where they have no leverage. And the other problem that we have is that being in those positions, that people tend to, people who are victims of sex trafficking tend to be in a vulnerable position, which makes them also vulnerable to the social services or law enforcement, which would ostensibly help them, ends up being at the very least unhelpful or perhaps adversarial. And so they can't go to the normal outlets, if you will, to get some type of help in these situations. At the end of the segment, you explained that the solutions for sex trafficking have to do with dealing with the circumstances that make them vulnerable and easily exploitable by people who are in a position to exploit them. So what does SESTA do and what does it or what is it ostensibly meant to do? And what is it, in fact, do people think is going to happen if SESTA passes?
So the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, SESTA, is a bill that is right now in the U.S. Senate. And the aim of it is both to clarify existing laws about the facilitation of sex trafficking, which is, you know, considered being knowingly facilitating or creating opportunities for sex trafficking, not just the trafficking itself. So basically attempts to go after the enablers. And the way that they do that primarily is by amending the Communications Decency Act, something called Section 230. So what Section 230 does is state that a website owner is not responsible for content that is put on that website by a third party if they, you know, abide by certain laws with regards to the nature and type of that content, like various institutional rules that govern each website that do make it illegal to post illegal things and take appropriate action for that. So basically, something that's interesting is that, like, this already basically exists. Facebook is required to take down porn or, you know, cases that are, you know, illegal content or that, you know, enable criminal activity. But what Section 230 has done for the internet and for free expression generally is sort of immeasurable, because it's like the reason we have any user-generated content on websites. It's how social media exists. It's how Amazon exists. It's how all of these places exist. And so specifically claiming that websites that offer advertising space to people who are offering sexual services and to hold this exceptionally high standard that doesn't require constitutional protections of that website in a number of different ways is a way of sort of, it zeroes in on websites that offer ads for sexual services, right? And so what people believe is that the ads are the best and, you know, easiest way to traffic people. Which is ostensibly true, that if you have an ad, you have much more visibility that you are offering this service. If you are offering a service illegally, it also means that you have a lot more visibility for people to respond to the ad, go to the service, and then realize that there's a person being trafficked. Like, it is the primary point. It's the first step where, you know, you can identify and pursue a trafficking case. If you take down all of the ads, you throw cold water on, like, a really hot tip for where these people are. One of the really exceptional cases is the site Redbook, which was in the Bay Area, and it had both ads for sex workers and community boards for sex workers to interact with each other, tip each other off that there were going to be raids, for clients to ask questions. And it was also where clients who, you know, had responded to an ad in, you know, whatever, quote unquote, good faith, however people identify people like going to a sex worker, and believed that the person there was coerced and in a dangerous situation. And they came back and asked sex workers on this board, like, hey, I think this person is trafficked. Should I call the police? Should I do this? Should I do that? And that the Freedom Network, which is the biggest coalition of anti-trafficking organizations in the country, has routinely said that the most underutilized resource for helping people people get out of trafficking situations is other people in the sex trades, whether they're there of their own free will, of their own enthusiasm, or out of, you know, financial necessity. That sex workers can better identify what coercion looks like. They have less stigma surrounding the fact that people are in the sex trades in the first place, and they know how to get people to the services that they need access to or the jobs they want access to in order to exit safely. And that's because a lot of people who are consensually doing sex work started out as victims of trafficking under all legal designations and then used sex work to escape that situation.
All right. So, Alana, if I understand it, the problem then, so what you're saying is that instead of actually inhibiting the profit-making element of sex trafficking, this is really just going to inhibit the best tool that advocates and perhaps law enforcement have for essentially exposing sex traffickers and rings and providing services and help for those people who are victimized by it. So the answers, to a certain extent, the story of SESTA seems like the story of a lot of things in our society where we will try and fix one of the symptoms or the second order issues instead of going to the root causes, which you've identified in this case, are really deal with the underlying issues that make people vulnerable to sex traffickers. That is their status either in this country in terms of documentation or their ability to meet their basic necessities, whether it's lodging, food, care for their children or whatnot. So the bottom line is SESTA is maybe well-intentioned, but it is not the right thing to do. Alana, I really appreciate your time today. And we will link to your piece in Allure magazine. Fascinating stuff.
If you want to actually eradicate the sex trades in general, one of the best ways to get rid of the worst elements of it is by listening to the people who are forced into the worst elements of it and giving them the tools to do it with a harm reduction model rather than an abolitionist model.
Alana Massey, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Alana Massey is a writer covering culture, identity, vice, and virtue. She's the author of the book All the Lives I Want and a forthcoming book about language, gender, and the workplace, both from Grand Central Publishing. You can read her piece if you care about sex trafficking, trust people in the sex trades, not celebrities, online over at Allure.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Bending facts to normalize racism has become the new calling card of the alt-right. Here to explain how this happened and discuss how groups like Stormfront are using social science to make racism more acceptable is Harvard history professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad. So, Khalil, you start your story discussing a panel that you were on with Derek Black. Tell us about Derek Black and why he's relevant to where we are in the trajectory of organized racism, I guess, in this country.
Sure. Well, Derek Black, as a young person, you can imagine that just about 10 years ago, we were celebrating the achievements of the MTV, VH1, social media generation of young people who'd grown up in a world far more tolerant and diverse than anything their parents or great-grandparents could claim. And that's unraveled. So one of the things that I think is fascinating about Derek Black is he grew up precisely over these years, in the 1990s and 2000s, the son of one of the most significant white supremacists and white nationalists in the country, a man named Don Black, who, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, runs Stormfront, one of the largest hate sites in the country. This young man has renounced his father's teachings. He's a graduate student at the University of Chicago. And tells a story, as has been widely reported in the Washington Post and elsewhere, that it was going to college in the first place that exposed him to competing ideas. And over a few Shabbat dinners with Jewish friends, he came to realize that he'd been taught hate, and he's renounced it. And so as a historian of white supremacy in this country, I was fascinated by having a chance to meet this young man and to hear his personal story and then to learn a few things about what's been going on over the past 18 months or so.
And okay, so he's giving you some insight in terms of what's been happening because he sort of he knows the code. Is that it?
Well, he grew up in it. So one way to think about this is people like Linda Gordon and many of my colleagues write about the Ku Klux Klan. I write about any number of social scientists, some of whom were absolutely white supremacists by any standard in today's terms. But as a historian, we don't usually get to meet these people or their relatives. So
right.
We rely on a fragmentary documentary record. But the fact is that the scholarship is very important. And for American history, it's critically important. And we teach this information to some degree much more in college than we do in K through 12. So intrinsically, this young man is very interesting because the worldview from which he hails not only stretches back to hundreds of years in this country, but also suggests to us what precisely those changes have been. And these are things that we need to study in the present, and we most certainly will look back on the Trump era and study them as historians.
Okay, so from the perspective, all right, so there's two things that a direct contact with a what theoretically down the road would be a historical figure that it offers you in particular as a historian. One is how this strain of racism or how racism presents itself today relative, and how it's different than, let's say, it was presented before. And also, I guess you're seeing the other side of the perspective of, you're studying this racism from sort of almost the receiving end as opposed to the projecting end. And so it's a little bit more timeless, I guess, in terms of what it shows, right? A certain dynamic. Tell us what you learned from in that respect, and then we'll talk about today, because there is a sort of, I don't know if how unique today is, but it is at least a specific story when we talk about the alt-right and when we talk about how things have been, have to be, I guess, converted into something more respectable. But in terms of that dynamic, what did you learn from seeing that racism generated and passed on from the inside?
Well, there's a very common misconception in our collective national memory, somewhere between what we learn in school and what we keep telling ourselves around the kitchen table. And that is that racism in America was aberrational, that it was the purview of a small group of people. When it was at its worst, they wore Klan hoods and burned crosses. And much of this horrible activity took place not only a long time ago, but took place in the South. So that's actually not true in the limited way in which we like to remember it. I'll just cite most recently, Linda Gordon's written a book about the second Klan, and her basic argument is that the resurgence of a second Klan, to be distinguished from the one that is born immediately after the Civil War in 1866, the second Klan emerges as a national movement. She estimates, along with others, about 4 million people, and there are chapters and pockets and political representatives in many, many states in the country. Her point in telling this story is that we have to see the Klan as a social movement, as a movement of ordinary Americans, many of whom were small business owners, many of whom were middle to upper income. They were not rank and file poor folks in terms of the heart of the movement in the way that we like to think they were. And they had chapters north, south, east, and west. That's really important because it does help to explain a recurring theme of what today we call populism, which is another way of saying backlash movements, sometimes rooted in economic anxiety, but oftentimes rooted in demographic change. That was an era that gave birth to immigration restrictions in 1924. This early Klan was responding to Catholics and Mexicans, blacks and Jews. But by and large, they were responding to people who were not white and Protestant. And we ended up closing our borders, the very borders that today are up for debate again because of the 1965 revision of those 1924 immigration restriction laws. So if we carry that earlier history to the present, one of the mistakes that many Americans make, again, is retreating to this notion that it's a small group of people who are our outliers in our society. They don't represent American values, and we shouldn't pay much attention to them. And God forbid we give them any airtime, because that will only fuel their nuttiness. Well, turns out that we keep learning that more and more of these people not only have much more significant presence in our communities, they are more affluent, more professional. Derek Black, for example, said that in all the conferences he attended over his 20-something years as a kid following his father, that the people who could travel were the people who had disposable income, who were the professional mobile classes. These were not people who were one paycheck away from the unemployment line. That's just one example, like Linda Gorton's findings, that this movement is much more present in our society than, again, a lot of people would like to think. So as a historian, what I find particularly compelling about this young man's story is that in our stories, we don't talk so much about the fine line between moderates and conservatives or racial conservatives and liberals and progressives, because generally we assume that racially conservative people track to people who are, you know, self-identified with, say, the Democratic Party of the Solid South back in the day, before 1968, or the contemporary modern Republican Party since, say, Ronald Reagan. But it turns out that white nationalists, under the guise of Don Black, his father, and Richard Spencer, and many others, are focusing on these conversations with white liberals who are feeling like the truth of Hispanic immigration is a threat to America's competitiveness in the world, to its limited social resources. I mean, Lindsey Graham did have a conversation nationally just a few years ago among other Republicans about whether we should repeal birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment in this country. So the basic argument that Derek makes is that a lot of what white nationalists are using to organize to come out of the shadows are the same basic debates that we're having in our political culture about demographic change in this country, about crime and safety, about education and achievement gaps.
All right, this is fascinating, and this also, I think, it is of particular interest to me, obviously, because this is where I start to intersect with these people online and on YouTube, and I start to see them, and we talk about alt-right and we talk about alt-light, and I'd like to talk about that when we return, because we see more. You know, Charles Murray has been on YouTube more, I would say, in the past 18 months than he had been in the media over the past 10 years. And we need to discuss that. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio, and I'm talking to Harvard professor and author of the book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, Khalil Muhammad. So, Khalil, you were talking in the last segment about what you learned from Derek Black, who is the son of Don Black, who was the founder of Stormfront.org. Derek Black has since, or I should say, by the time that you had met him, had left his father's, I guess, teachings, and gave you particular insight as a historian as to the makeup of those folks who follow a guy like Don Black, and also an acute awareness, which I imagine you had some as well as a historian, but it helps to explicate to others, of the persistence and the nature of racism in this country. I mean, it is interwoven into the fiber of this country. And in terms of movements, it is there in a far more present way than I think most people would appreciate. But let's talk about the idea of coming out of the shadows, as you talked about, that there is now an attempt for folks like Richard Spencer, for folks at Stormfront. I would take this through the alt-right, and we'd get to people like Milo Yiannopoulos and others who are attempting to bring forward these racist ideas, but package them in a much more palatable and almost intellectual way. I mean, you talk about the New Orleans Protocol. Tell us about that and where that leads.
So the New Orleans Protocol comes on the heels of 9/11. It's a 2004 gathering in New Orleans of a number of white supremacist organizations. David Duke is the inspiration for the protocol, having learned many lessons from his years of organizing as a Klan and then as an elected official. And essentially, the protocol argues that the movement has to evolve, in some ways take a page from the civil rights movement itself, by resorting to a kind of politics of respectability where it will fundamentally or officially renounce violence, which is a sharp break from its Klan roots. It will uphold a kind of standard of upstanding behavior among its followers and will finally make sure that it brings its best, literally its A game, to its public presentations, which means that people following the protocol are prepared with facts and figures to win arguments. Now, that can be confusing to people because people just assume facts are facts are facts. Right. Well, we know that not to be the case. The fact of global climate change does not necessarily yield universal consensus as to whether this is normal climate change or whether it's man-induced climate change. That's just one example. And of course, the scientific community is of consensus, but many Americans in this country and certainly the politics in this country are fraught around these questions. The issue of the facts of opioid crisis has produced overwhelming consensus that it's a public health crisis, but the fact of opioid or heroin use or crack cocaine use in black communities has not produced a consensus that it's a public health crisis. So what they do is they present facts that already attach to pre-existing ideological beliefs. Black people are overrepresented in crime statistics, especially violent ones. Well, it already sits on top of centuries of history assuming that black people are more violent. So the fact only leads to the inevitable conclusion in a white nationalist mind frame that black people are predisposed to violence and there's nothing really we can do about it except more policing or prisons or find ways to keep black people from coming to America. So they have mined the universe of government-produced statistics as quote-unquote facts to make the case to people who are not particularly well-informed or educated about these issues, who, when confronted with this information, begin to draw upon their own beliefs and observations and retreat behind that information to say, well, yeah, it seems to me you're right. Why are we throwing good money at bad? We should just close the borders to Hispanics with all their gang violence and, as the president said, they're rapists and criminals. It's this kind of relationship between things that you can find that are quote-unquote facts in our government-produced data, but that sit with very complicated interpretations and histories and contexts that most liberals who are attuned to are able to respond to, but many moderates and liberals right. who are not attuned to are not.
Right. And so it's the stripping of all of this context. And frankly, you know, this is something that we talk about around here, too, about we see this with folks like, you know, like a Sam Harris, who is talking about Islam in this way that is very narrowly sliced without seeing context. And we see a lot of the sort of the mainstreaming of these facts and the presenting of, you know, sitting down and being open to ideas and facts with Charles Murray. I raise him again just because we see him on various YouTube programs by ostensible liberals, right, who are just willing to deal with facts and putting emotions aside. But in fact, we're talking about people who are cherry-picking facts, presenting them without context, and using misconceptions. There's plenty of data out there to suggest that both white and, frankly, black people have misconceptions about where black people are situated, about black families in this country that has been developed by the media over time. And so this is what's being exploited. And the big difference today, I think what you're suggesting, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that there is a savvy about this as a technique it's no longer obvious to this racist Klansman that nobody wants to live next to a black person. You know, no white guy wants to live next to a black person. They're coming out and they're making an argument that seems like it's reasoned, and there's a certain savvy involved in that.
That's exactly right. And the savvy in it is not to lead with, I hate black people, or all black people are this. The savvy is to lead with, why is there so much crime, as Derek Bell described, on the south side of Chicago? And so people find themselves saying, well, I don't really understand. And the next thing you know, they've got you, because it's going to reduce to the fact that black people, like Haitians, like Somalis, bring bad news wherever they live and congregate. That's the basic way in which they approach it, which is very different than how most Americans think about what a white supremacist says to you when they're articulating their racism. And I will also add that this particular moment that Derek Black described, and another person I interviewed for the Nation article, Jared Taylor, who runs another website and a larger community called American Renaissance, which hosts conferences, they essentially have said, Derek Black and Jared Taylor, that since the murder of Trayvon Martin and the protest around George Zimmerman's acquittal, and then follow that with Michael Brown and Ferguson and Eric Garner, that it has been even easier for them to organize, because many more white Americans don't understand the critique of state violence and see the Black Lives Matter movement as illegitimate. And that gets wrapped up in this zero-sum game of police officers being upstanding white men sacrificing themselves to try to protect black people, and black people being ungrateful and living in crime-infested communities, exactly the kind of rhetoric that won Trump many voters and got him universal praise from every professional police organization in the country.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. His most recent article for The Nation, Racism by the Numbers, appears in their January 29th special issue, The Resistance Turns One, Saying No to Trump Was Just the Beginning.